Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. So, the Money Maze podcast is thrilled to have the first person to reappear on the show. And so, General Sinnott Carter came on the show in March as the Ukraine war was breaking, and we thought it'd be fantastic to get an update. So, we have a special edition here. Nick, welcome back to the Money Maze podcast.
Thanks, Sam. It's a great privilege to be re-invited. It means the first one perhaps went okay, so I'm delighted to hear all that.
And how have things been in the intervening months as you go through this new stage in your life?
I've been focused very much on job hunting, which has been fascinating. We military are not great networkers, so I've had to learn a new skill. But I have to say that my exposure on Money Maze has been hugely helpful. It's led to a lot of quite interesting conversations with some potential future employers. So I'm very grateful, Simon. Thank you.
That's terrific to hear. Let's jump in. Ukraine. We all read a lot. We all think we have a sense of what's happening, but you have a much better sense. There feels like echoes of Stalingrad of old and then new weaponry. And I think it was Professor Sir Lawrence Freeman of King's College who said Russians are adapting into becoming a 20th century army, while the Ukrainians are becoming more of a 21st century army. Just what is going on?
I mean, that's an interesting observation. I suspect the truth lies somewhere in between. The answer is that I think Russia, after initially being rather too ambitious, shall we say, in terms of its political and military objectives, has now decided that its predominant target seems to be the Donbass, and in particular, Donetsk and Luhansk. And yes, I think we've now reverted to the sort of warfare that our forebears in either the 1940s or even 1418 might have recognized with trenches and massed artillery systems. But I think that would be to oversimplify it, because the reality, of course, is we're seeing new technology being applied with old technology. So essentially, you're seeing both sides using unmanned aerial vehicles extensively. The Russians are doing that in order to target both long-range missile systems, not that they've got that many left, I think most experts now reckon, but importantly also to target their dumb artillery, of which they've got a lot. And indeed, I think RUSI, the think tank, thought that they were using around 20,000 152mm shells per day in their current offensive in the Donbass, which is really quite significant. compared to the Ukrainians, who've probably only got about 6,000 shells they can fire a day. So very much overmatched. And of course, what Russia seems to be doing is trying to grind out the battle to fix the Ukrainians, but also, I think, to seize Donetsk and Luhansk and potentially to encircle what remains of the Ukrainian army in the east. And of course, that's going to be the key decision in all of this. When they've done that, I suspect Russia will look up to Kharkiv, Ukraine's second city, which, as you know, has not yet fallen. There's been a lot of fighting and counteroffensives around it. And then I think Ukraine clearly would be quite anxious to look at Kherson. And we might come back to the question of Kherson because it's quite important for other reasons.
In our interview in March, you said Putin has lost. My question is, how do you assess that situation now? And how do we define loss?
Well, you're right. Winning and losing has to be defined against the objectives you set yourselves. And certainly if you go back to the 24th of February, I think we reckoned at that stage that Putin's objective was to subsume all of Ukraine into the Russian orbit. And of course, he talked about denazification and demilitarization. So set against those objectives, I think it's self-evident that he has not succeeded. But I also think he's lost in other ways. And he's lost because I think President Zelensky's remarkable leadership has meant that Ukraine really will now, I think, stay as an independent state with a significant quantity of her territory, even if the battle for the Donbass, we're not clear how that'll unfold over time. Secondly, of course, I don't think Mr. Putin would have wanted the European Union to have offered Ukraine candidate status for membership of the EU at any stage in this process. So I think that is undoubtedly a loss. And of course, we now have applications from Finland and Sweden to join NATO. Again, I don't think Putin would have wanted that to happen, even if he would have recognized that those two countries were firmly in the Western ambit through the business of the European Union. So that is a loss. But I think more profoundly, whilst we don't see any dissent in Russia yet, there are cracks. Some of the elite, and also some of the senior military figures who've appeared on television over the last 4 weeks or so, give an indication that perhaps Putin is not as respected at home as he once was. And the longer this war goes on, the harder it is going to be for him to maintain the respect of the elites in Russia. Now, I don't think he will lose provincial Russia quickly, because there are a lot of people in provincial Russia who want strong leadership and still regard him as that strong leader. But I think for all those reasons, he's undoubtedly lost a great deal of ground. Now, what that means in relation to Ukraine and how Ukraine wins and how you define that sort of victory, we could carry on in this conversation. But back to you.
Without engaging in wishful thinking, there has been some, and I quoted earlier on Professor Freeman of King's College, but there has been some narrative about the potential for the Ukrainians to develop some offensive that the Russians can't easily reverse. You're a military man. When academics launch themselves into this space, there's inevitably theory meets experience. What's your perspective?
First of all, it's a very interesting interview in the Times today, in which the Ukrainian defense minister sets out his ambition for how he rebuilds his armed forces into armed forces that are equipped and organized along NATO lines. And indeed, the headline rather interestingly talks about 1 million Ukrainians being put under arms. Well, all of that, I'm sure, is possible, but it will take a very long time to do. Creating, first of all, the human capacity that's able to fill these places in the Ukrainian army is not done overnight. And then trying to train people on the new NATO equipment, whether that's tanks or artillery pieces or drones or whatever else it might be that they will be receiving. And then importantly, training them to be able to bring all of those bits of equipment together into a coherent whole is the work of quite some months and if not years. So I think what that interview would indicate is that there's definitely ambition to do something about this, but we would have to expect it to go on for some time yet, which asks all sorts of other questions about Western patience, which we can perhaps come back to in this conversation. Having said that, I think that Ukraine will probably look to do some stuff locally quite soon. I think they are very interested in Kherson, which is that city down near Crimea and is a very important region. It is, after all, the only regional capital that Russia has been able to seize during the course of this war. And of course, it's a very important piece of ground in relation to the sustainability of Crimea, because within Kherson is the town of Kakhovka, which is where there is an important dam which allows water to flow to the Crimea. So it's important that Russia maintains this. And of course, it's also that region in many ways an agricultural powerhouse. Russia would be very keen to assimilate that into Russia proper, not as a simply as a breakaway republic like maybe Luhansk and Donetsk become, not least because, of course, there's a very significant power station there, and that nuclear power station will manage the requirements that Crimea has into the longest possible term. So there are all sorts of good reasons, I think, why it's important. And I think Ukraine will be thinking at the moment about whether the local counterattacks on the boundaries and edges of that region of Kherson can turn into something a bit more significant. There's stuff going on, but the big question, I think, is how quickly they can do it and how quickly they can become capable enough to be able to embrace all of this Western know-how and technology to be able to achieve a genuine offensive.
As an observer, of course, one talks and listens to the discussion on military strategy, and it's almost akin to moving pieces on a chessboard. But your successor, General Sir Patrick Sanders, has said this is the clearest threat in our lifetime, as profound as a 1937 moment. And I wonder, whilst it's easy to strategize, and we're all doing that, is the West in aggregate possibly being too complacent about escalation?
As I've said before, the first casualty of war is always the truth. What's going on in this war is there are narratives on both sides. Ukraine is understandably bigging up and emphasizing its desire to take back its territory and its capability to do that because it wants to try and get the support necessary to do that. And then there'll be a counter narrative that, of course, Russia will put across. But I think, like all these things, we have to sit back and be realists about what is achievable. And I think we, therefore, as the West, need to be clear about whether we are able to enable Ukraine to do the sorts of things that Ukraine are talking about doing. As I said a moment ago, it will take time to do that. And whether we've got the patience to be able to cope with the privations that come with sanctions, for example, is a big question, which we might want to return to. But I do very much agree with one of my successors, Patrick Sanders, said, and indeed, back in January 2018, I was saying much the same sorts of things about Russia. But of course, it's now much more obvious that that is the problem. And I think it is, in many ways, a very clear and present threat to us. But of course, we shouldn't ignore all the other things that are going on in the world in the meantime, because whilst Russia is the most obvious acute threat, China is the chronic challenge. And that's something we shouldn't lose sight of as we fix on Russia at the moment.
Yes, and I want to come back to that later on. Coming back to an earlier observation you made, which is all wars end in a conversation, and that involves compromise. What's your best guess?
I suspect that it's very likely that Russian forces will at some stage in the next 6 to 12 weeks will what we military call culminate in the Donbass. I think they'll run out of energy in terms of human capacity and arguably munitions and those sorts of things they need to carry on. At that point, Mr. Putin will seek to freeze the conflict in the way that he's frozen conflicts in Georgia, in Azerbaijan and Armenia, and of course also in Moldova. And in freezing the conflict, of course, that then becomes a very dangerous moment for all of us, because that will be the point at which he comes to the negotiating table. And you can see a sort of son of Minsk in terms of that agreement playing out. And of course, there will be people who will be tempted to negotiate on our side at that point, because of course they will want an end to the war for all sorts of obvious reasons. The challenge, of course, is going to be how President Zelensky sees it, because, of course, for him, he has a mandate from his people, I think, to fight on to whatever the finish might look like, and also to try and reclaim his lost territories. I would have thought we're going to end up at a point of time in probably in the autumn where the thing freezes, then there will be a very challenging moment where Mr. Putin might come to the table, and then there will be this question about how do we play this and how do Ukraine play this, because Ukraine will want to fight on. But will we in the West be prepared to tolerate the privations that come with a long war and therefore sanctions having to be applied for much longer?
And do you think the West is likely to splinter?
We've seen fault lines, but on the other hand, we haven't reached the point at which it's become genuinely uncomfortable. It's going to require leadership, and it's going to require particularly US leadership, but leadership from Western statespeople to be able to hold it together. Another gilet jaune type moment that we all recall from 2 or 3 years ago, you know, that sort of thing doesn't help. So I don't know. I think it's too early to say, but it's going to require strong leadership, and it's going to require marshalling a narrative that our populations can genuinely get behind to understand why they are being asked to do this and why it matters that they do it. And the same applies, frankly, to those who are supporting Mr. Putin in the global south. We need to be thinking about how we are going to lean into them. Because at the moment, two-thirds of the world is either sitting on the fence or supporting Mr. Putin.
And the narrative there is that for some, they see it as not so wildly different from the US invasion of Iraq. And have they been moved at all by what presumably is behind the scenes vigorous conversation from the West to bring them around?
I think President Biden's visit to the Middle East this week will be an interesting moment. We'll see where that leads. I think the Global South, unsurprisingly, is looking at this thinking that perhaps the West has been rather duplicitous over the last 20 years. And we have to find a way of re-establishing our values and living those values. We also need to think about how we call out Mr. Putin's imperialism, because I think it is his imperialism, which is, one would hope, the word that might stick in the throats of various leaders in the Global South.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come. But a quick word on our new sponsor. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, CEO of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine. And as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. LiveTrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, bordeauxindex.com/LiveTrade. The Money Maze podcast is also brought to you by our final sponsor, Mintos. The world of art investing has been typically out of reach for most investors, and yet returns have been very impressive. Mintos is a new concept in art investing, giving investors the chance to own the unownable through an FCA-authorized and regulated fractionalization platform, which offers access to iconic and rare paintings from contemporary art masters like Warhol, Kondo, Francis Bacon and Basquiat. Actual paintings, not digital assets. For investors seeking to diversify their portfolios through an asset class historically uncorrelated with stock market investing and with strong returns, we've been impressed with Mintos and think it merits a closer look. Peter Frankopan, who head of Global History at Oxford, who you met at one of our Money Maze podcast events, had a question, which is, what threats are we not thinking about, but perhaps we should be? That's made in the global context.
I think we need to look at the geography. We need to look at the bigger picture. We need to see, for example, what Russia is doing in its near abroad and up into the Arctic and the high north. And we need to look at what Russia is doing with its militia group, the Wagner group, more broadly. That's an important area to focus on. We need to be looking at how China is expanding its influence globally, particularly in Africa, but also in Latin America. Russia is doing the same in Latin America. And then we can't afford to ignore terrorism, extremism, and of course, how that bears on climate change and people wishing to migrate from continents like Africa to Europe. And those are things that are very much clear and present challenges for us. And then, of course, there are capability areas like cyber, like space, where both Russia and China have significant capability. There's plenty, I think, for policymakers to get their minds around at the moment. And suddenly, we realize that the world is essentially much more complex, more dynamic, and inherently unstable than it's been at any times in our lifetime.
So we've got China, Russia, we've got energy, food, climate. You talked about the global south. Lots of troublesome balls in the air. Cast your mind forward 5 years. How would you assess the resolution or lack of resolution around some of these key issues?
A lot is going to depend upon how domestic politics play out in Western countries. In the horizon that you've just put out there, of course, we will have had a US election. And how that US election pans out is going to be absolutely fundamental to the way in which the West approaches the challenges that you've just mentioned. The same applies to Western politics more generally. I can't remember a time in my lifetime, I think, when the notion of democracy felt more threatened. I think Francis Fukuyama was right in his book, The End of History, when he observed that democracy will die from within, not from without. And I think that's the bit that is the indeterminate factor in all of this, which we all need to be alert to. But having said all of that, if you take China, for example, and a number of other authoritarian or more authoritarian countries, I think they will have reflected on the Western response to what Russia has done in Ukraine. And I think they will realize that actually the West does stand for something, and the West is probably not going to put up with what it stands for being undermined by people like Mr. Putin. And I think that's quite an important message, which means I think that the risk of further instability in the next 5 years probably becomes slightly less.
And do you include Taiwan in that?
I think that President Xi Jinping will have reflected and been quite thoughtful about the Western response to Russia's foreign reserves in Western institutions. And given the amount of Chinese money that sits in Western institutions, I think he will have thought quite hard about the impact of that. And indeed, I think he's trying to sort it out probably. I think that he probably has put Taiwan slightly more on the back burner than it might have been. But I always remember my Australian opposite number when I was in my previous job suggesting that the next decade is going to be really decisive in terms of how things play out in the Indo-Pacific region, and in particular in Taiwan. Because President Xi Jinping, in the same way as President Putin, is not getting any younger. They're both in their late 60s. And of course, they both want to leave legacies. President Xi was very clear about what he thinks Taiwan's proper place is in his vision. So I don't think this problem is going to go away. So much of it will depend upon how we in the West behave, but also, of course, how Taiwan behaves throughout this.
So let's come back to home. You talked about the importance of leadership. It couldn't be a more appropriate time, given the turmoil at the head of the Conservative Party. And our mutual friend, Colonel Johnny Gray, who served with you in Iraq, said, what lessons can number 10 draw about crisis management from the Boris years?
Well, I'm in a slightly difficult position because, of course, I was his military advisor probably for 80% of his time. And therefore, I sat on his National Security Council, and many of the decisions that were made by that body during his tenure were very sensible decisions. I think a lot of the COVID decisions were pretty good. And I also think the government's response to Ukraine has been pretty good. His response to the Afghan denouement was pretty good as well. So I think crisis management has been effectively handled. I think the challenge for all leaders, though, in democracies is how you look beyond the crisis to where you want things to end. And that requires a strategic approach. And that's very difficult for all leaders these days, partly, of course, because the news cycle is so dynamic, but also, of course, because of the nature of the democratic cycle. And to be fair to the Prime Minister, being elected on the back of an 80-seat majority, he probably thought that he could look beyond the first term into a second term. And therefore, I think there could have been some quite significant strategic ideas that could have been developed. And the integrated review that was published in March of last year tried to do that. It was being translated into a strategy, I think, during the course of the last year or so. But ultimately, what it aspired to do, I think, was, as a vision, lauded by many people, not least our allies. I'm not going to pass judgment one way or the other. I just think that these are very difficult times. And I think some of the crises that we were involved in were difficult to deal with. And I think they were handled as well as they might have been in the circumstances. Yes, mistakes were made. Of course, mistakes were made. But in principle, I think they were handled pretty well. And of course, it is that body that is the National Security Council that is the mechanism through which we make sure that crisis management is handled effectively.
Charles Moore, writing in Spectator, said, and I quote him, Boris's trust in instinct rather than process left him dangerously exposed. And I just was mulling over that. And when it comes to process, the civil service is absolutely central, as are the board of advisors who surround these key leaders. And you've seen it from the inside. And I wondered how you think the process and the machinery works, and could it work better?
All processes could work better. I've mentioned the integrated review earlier. I mean, I think that was handled in a very effective way across government. We do that integration across government pretty well in the UK. It goes back, ironically, I think, to the way Whitehall was laid out by our forebears when they were policing an empire, where it was helpful to have an organisational structure in which everybody could walk to the important ministries that mattered. And you can still do that in Whitehall. I think it's pretty good in terms of integration. The challenge for all policymakers, though, is how do you think for the long term? And then how do you, given the pace of events and the dynamic nature of the strategic context, genuinely have a strategic approach to what you're trying to do? And it is very difficult to do. And show me a country other than an authoritarian state that does it well at the moment.
I want to ask a question which isn't really being asked, which is, have sanctions been an abject failure? I was reading a piece about this, which highlighted in Russia, Putin's popularity is high. The exporters in Russia are clearly making a lot of money. The ruble's been the world's strongest currency. Not a single Ukrainian has been helped by the sanctions. The Western Europe is being throttled here by the energy costs. Poorer countries are being throttled by grain prices. Actually, is it possible that the sanctions themselves were and are counterproductive?
First and foremost, of course, Russia is in many ways a closed economy. Because of that nature of that closed economy, they're much better able to ride out sanctions than perhaps Western countries are. And of course, what we've seen is that the Russian economy in that closed fashion has somewhat recovered since the 24th of February. It's interesting that the ruble is now at a price that it was at on the 24th of February. And of course, it's interesting the amount of foreign exchange that Putin continues to earn through selling fossil fuels to those countries who are prepared to acquire his fossil fuels. But I think where it will be hurting him is particularly with Western technology, because for things like precision munitions and for things like aircraft and more sophisticated platforms, they need Western components, and those components are harder to get. He will have found black market routes of getting him in there, but not at the scale he probably needs. And I think that's going to have a bearing upon the way the elites see how this war is going, because not being able to access Western technology in their industries, but also to replace things that break, whether that's an Apple computer or an iPhone or whatever else it might be, that will begin to become awkward and will become uncomfortable. So I'm afraid what I think one has to say is that sanctions of the order of magnitude that have been applied over the last 3 or 4 months, we need to be patient in seeing them through. And we also need to be working out how we ensure that others are not finding ways around those sanctions, because that, going back to Putin's foreign exchange, is going to be a problem if people continue to buy his fossil fuels. The bigger question is, which is the other side of patience, is what it means to the West, what it means to countries in the developing world that are struggling with food shortages and cooking oil shortages and those sorts of things at the moment, is how long can this go on for? Now, of course, one of the advantages of what's happening is that countries like Germany are now looking to see whether they can reduce their dependency on Russian energy to be able to do that, which has got to be a good thing. So I think it's a complex question. I think there are upsides and there are downsides. But the big question is, have we got the patience to be able to see this through? Because seeing it through is not going to be something that we see happen to Russia quickly.
Which leads me to my final question, is these supply chains via Odessa, how can they be unblocked? How can the West, and what can the West do to facilitate the export of all this stuff that comes through there?
If you take the model that we've applied over many years in the Gulf, where we have made sure that we assure the ability of the West, and all nations for that matter, to be able to export oil and gas through the Straits of Hormuz, by having a significant maritime presence there. Now, is that a model that we could apply in the Black Sea? And I'm no longer obviously involved in all of this, but it may well be that with the support of Turkey, it may well be possible for NATO to be able to find a way of unblocking the blockade that exists around ports like Odessa. And I think that's one of those things that we're going to have to think pretty hard about if we are going to need to be patient about the way in which the sanctions continue to work. Having said that, people will be very nervous about the nature of escalation that could flow from that. We've already seen a certain amount of excitement around Kaliningrad, that narrow sliver of land in the Baltic, which separates Lithuania from Poland and is owned by Russia. How these things play out in terms of escalation is something that planners and policymakers will need to be very careful about, and have been very careful over the last 3 or 4 months. So can we break a blockade without it becoming so escalatory that it leads to something else occurring? I don't know. These are questions that people will be asking. But ultimately, we do need to find a way, if this war is going to go on for a while, of opening up Ukraine's economy, because otherwise things are going to become even worse than they are now.
It's great to catch up. I think that our listeners will really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts in what is incredibly complicated and scary. time for our civilization. The combination of, from an economic and investment standpoint, I think the combination of these higher commodity prices, reduced economic activity, and a higher cost of debt that was always going to happen because central banks have arguably been way too relaxed and behind the curve, means that we're in for a continued difficult time. The one piece of the energy equation that continues to come back to me, and I have been buying more of it, is uranium, which can be bought not and delivered to your house, but can be bought through things like Sprott Physical Uranium Trust in the US market and Yellowcake in the UK. So there are always opportunities, we know, from an investing standpoint. So thank you so much. Good luck with your discussions, and we will perhaps have another update at some point in the future. Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.